the way that the public interacts with elected officials has changed over time. There seems to be, and I think a lot of people listening here would agree, there just seems to be this undercurrent of frustration and anger in systems, and whether that's in the educational or faith systems or government, it's just pervasive. There is something to me about the potential of AI for climate change, for, you know, we're talking about deep fakes. It also has the ability for actually being the way that you determine whether information is real or not. To me, it's augmenting the collective human intelligence in a way that we've never been able to do before. And if we can harness that, the things that we screwed up along the way in the world and the climate and famine and things that are going to continue to contribute to strife, I think can really be addressed through this. That is exceptionally exciting. That's why I'm passionate. I mean, I'm not a particularly exciting guy when it comes to regulatory. Like, I don't wake up every day thinking about regulatory frameworks, but I am passionate about the idea of how we can get this one right, because the potential is so much more than anything else we've touched before. I think that's really exciting. And I think that it's important for industry folks to know the government has a role there in a way that can be beneficial, and to see that they've got a seat at the table in a way they never have before.
Hi, I'm Boaz, founder and CEO of Simply Augmented, and I'm excited that you are tuning in to Shift AI, a show that explores what it takes to thrive and adapt to the changing workplace in the digital age of remote work and AI. In today's episode, I'm thrilled to have Zach Friend as our guest. Zach is currently a Santa Cruz County Supervisor, representing constituents in Silicon Valley and a voice advocating for responsible AI regulation. If you're someone interested in the way that governments are dealing with AI and the social contract that needs to be established with their constituents, you're going to love this episode. It's great to have Zach on our podcast, and we can't wait to learn more from him. Let's get to it. All right, Zach, thank you for being on the Shift AI podcast. I am super excited to have you on. We're going to talk about all sorts of interesting things around AI and regulation today. Thank you for joining.
I'm really excited to be on. I admire a lot of the stuff that you've done, been able to accomplish, and I'm excited to have this conversation with you today.
Great, great. Well, you know that I always like to start with everyone's accomplishments, and you have many. And I'm going to read them back to you. If I get anything wrong, you can correct me, and we'll have some time to go over that. So very, very interesting career. Council of Economic Advisors, Democratic Policy Committee, United States Senate, United States House of Representatives, you were involved there. Deputy National Security Special Projects for the Democratic National Committee. Press Secretary for Obama for America. Santa Cruz Policy Press Information Officer, Crime Analyst, City of Santa Cruz. So you have this kind of local and federal experience. National Media Surrogate for Biden for President. And then Santa Cruz County Supervisor, County of Santa Cruz, which is dear to my heart. I've spent some time at the University of California, Santa Cruz. We met recently at an event where we were both there speaking. And so really, really amazing background. And it's perfect because today we're going to talk a lot about AI regulation. And I've done a lot of work with the president and the White House around AI regulation. So before we jump into it, did I get it close? Most of that stuff, right.
Yeah. It makes me sound interesting. It also makes me sound like I can't hold a job. So for longer than a short period of time. But no, that's exactly right. I've been very fortunate to have a lot of, in particular on the public side, a lot of experiences.
Before we get into that, though, I always like to kind of put a human element to this. Where did you grow up? And, you know, what was your first job where you actually got paid, you know, what part of the country did you grow up in?
I grew up in San Diego, California. My very first job was actually, I went door to door trying to allow people to let me mow their lawns and pull their weeds. And I got to say that I was probably 9 or 10 years old at the time. I mean, people were willing to take me up on it because I just underpriced what my lawn mowing skill set was. I mean, I had a lot of the childhood jobs. I delivered newspapers and, but my first job sort of in the real world was I actually delivered cars for Toyota, you know, that like the fleet
really?
Car. Yeah. So when you're trying to get cars between dealerships, like somebody buys a car in one part of town, but they don't have the color that they wanted, you know, they'll do a dealer trade with another thing. So I was, believe it or not, I was like the 16-year-old, you know, driving probably speeding too much on San Diego freeways to get the car between two different places.
What does your parents do for a living down in San Diego? Is that where both your parents had their careers?
Yes, they are now both retired. In fact, my father just recently retired. Both of them were in the medical field forever. I mean, my father was a physician. My mom was a nurse. My mom also ran my dad's medical practice. It's a pretty interesting thing. They were independent their entire career, so they didn't join any of these large groups or any of the corporate medicine systems. And he was the oldest rounding physician, actually, at a major hospital here all the way till he was 80. His calling was really providing, and the majority of his patients, actually more than the majority, almost exclusively, were public insurance patients, so people on the Medicaid system or Medicare system. So he's a strong believer in providing care for those with the least means, and so they were clearly, both of them were an inspiration on how you can use whatever skill set you were given to help the public.
I'm surprised they didn't drag you into medicine. How did you get into politics? Politics and business something talked about in the family? Was that a dinner table conversation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I have vivid memories of my parents always reading the newspaper, having NPR on or the news, and we did talk about current events throughout my entire family, actually, my grandparents as well. For me, I think that I've always been interested in intractable problems and trying to find solutions to them. Not in an engineering standpoint, I don't have that kind of skill set, but from a human standpoint. And that's what got me interested in the political side, was realizing that there's a connection between those two things, that you can use the public sector for good.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you just got back from a trip to Washington, D.C. You were at the White House. I'm sure you were talking about lots of different things, but one of them was AI. Right. Can you talk a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing in the AI space as it relates to policy?
Yeah, I would love to. So to me, I think it's important to start with that this is an undefined regulatory space, and that can be exciting and terrifying depending upon either side. If you're on the government regulatory side, it's both exciting and terrifying. And if you're on the business side, it's both exciting and terrifying.
Yeah.
And I saw, as an elected at the county level, and for those who may not know, Santa Cruz County is really adjacent to Silicon Valley, and a significant number of people that live in my county are involved in the broader tech industry. So it's a pretty active space that way. But it has a history of a very strong ethos of data and privacy protections, and also being at the forefront of policymaking. And it became clear that it would be hard at the state or federal level to really lead these discussions. I mean, you saw Brussels just most recently actually come out with some regulatory frameworks.
Yeah.
But D.C. seems to struggle right now with harmony on any issue, and in particular the regulatory framework. So I decided to try and draft something on my own, meaning what we could do would be at the county level, could we come up with a framework that other governments could use at the local, state, or federal level on the AI regulatory framework? And it started from a values-based standpoint. I mean, this is a space that's evolving so quickly, I think it's very difficult to put very prescriptive requirements on it. But I think that we're all in agreement that social media regulatory frameworks didn't work out, or maybe we're a little too late. And so to the degree that we can come together on the industry side and the business and the government side on trying to come up with a values-based framework of how to harness the potential here. And so that's how I got started with it. Because I have longstanding relationships, been very fortunate that way on the federal side, in particular with this administration, we were able to share what we're doing with the administration, and I work on some other national ways to do that. And you know, here we are. I mean, I think that we're moving forward toward a regulatory framework that actually benefits both the country as a whole and doesn't stifle innovation, which is very important.
It's such a good time to be talking about it. Obviously, the executive order happened this summer. The AI Act looks like it's going to get done before the end of the year in the EU. Maybe talk a little bit about, at the local level, what you've been thinking about, what's in place. You know, when we met in Santa Cruz, there was a lot of interest in that area, sold out show, and we were speaking, and you know, people really care about this and they want to know about it. So how did it play out in your county?
Well, one of the advantages of the local is you can do something a lot faster than they can at the state or federal level. And as I said, I thought that it made sense to do it from a values-based standpoint. And so what does that mean? I mean, at the county level, and counties are functionally arms of the state and to a lesser degree of the federal government, really state governments, but we carry out a lot of state and federal mandates, and in particular in jail systems or health and human service systems. So we deal with a lot of sensitive data, and we deal with a lot of vendors that may also be incorporating AI into systems that we're not even aware of in ways that may violate our own privacy rules or maybe the community wouldn't necessarily support. But we also see it as it's very hard to hire talent right now. It's very expensive, not just from a talent standpoint, but we live in one of the most expensive places in the country, so recruiting is very hard. And so maybe AI tools could also significantly improve outputs in customer service. So I started from the standpoint of this technology, and we're using it very broadly. I mean, AI has a lot of applications, as you know.
Sure.
But the general sense is that it's here to stay. This isn't a flash in the pan advancement, as some previous technologies maybe were. This is actually transformational. How do we harness it? How do we also guardrail it? That was just the 10,000-foot view. And what we did that I think was an interesting model is that we joined with industry on a working group. This is one of the advantages of being so close to Silicon Valley, is having these industry leaders. But we got their input. I mean, I think that it's a valid fear of industry that government will, especially when they don't know something, don't have an understanding, they'll overregulate and stifle that innovation.
Yeah.
My pitch to industry was different. Wouldn't you rather have a seat at the table to help inform us about how the proper ways to regulate this new space? And there's a trust gap there, I mean, to be fair, and there's a knowledge gap in government versus industry, but it was interesting also having people in the AI space, the AI startup space, that acknowledge that even they don't know what the what the potential is, right? And we came up with a set of key principles that we're following that became our policy, one of the first in the country, and now a model policy across the country at the county level that deals with a various set of things. I mean, like data privacy and security components. It was important our community to have informed consent, basically, so when members of the community are engaging with an AI tool, that there's like an opt-out alternative, or just so that they know that it isn't something that's used as a final decision. But I mean, this is really important. It isn't a hiring tool, and although I can see and I've heard you speak to this, you know, I mean, but at the government level, there's a different standard of hiring that I think is very that needs to be very transparent and different.
Absolutely.
That we want to ensure that there's transparency is also associated with it, so that everybody that's using it knows that it's being used. If you're citing it, that it's cited openly, et cetera. But we wanted our employees to use it. This is something that I think is different from a lot of there are governments banning it right now, in particular like the ChatGPT function or Bard or others. We want people to use it. We want people to try it. We want to see how it's going to help. And we've already started to see significant improvements as a result of it from a time perspective. And I think that's very exciting because we're just in its infancy.
I think that's a big distinction from what you did, because it really encouraged people to say, this is going to be happening and you're going to have to understand how to use it. And your constituents are going to be using it too. And so we should all understand how this is going to be powerful. So I think that is the right approach. And I have seen a lot of state and local governments just walk away from it and say, we're not using it. You can't use it. You can't upload your content. So I think that really is interesting. How does it compare to what and the kind of conversations that you're having in DC? You know, it was very interesting to see the framework that the executive order laid out, but it was short on specifics. And when I interviewed folks that have talked to Biden before, they expressed interesting conversations about deepfakes, about the way that it was going to influence elections, but also about big ideas and how it related to healthcare and healthcare innovation. What are some of the things that you can talk about that you've been discussing with the Biden White House?
Well, I think that you were spot on in what my sense is of his thinking on this, which is that I think he clearly sees enormous potential, in particular in the healthcare space, which is near and dear to him, and some of the challenges he's had in his own family, the tragedies he's had in his own family. But I mean, look, what we saw in 2016 and 2020, it's clear that misinformation in particular, the ability, and we're seeing it right now in the current wars, the ability to really influence public opinion is real through misinformation. And so they wanted to ensure that the 2024 election wasn't sort of an ongoing fight in the same ways that the previous elections were, and could they get out ahead of that with the large players. I think that there's a point that's often missed on the executive order, which is that, you know, it speaks to a size of business that really doesn't apply to almost every business that's currently in the space. There's only a couple of players that this really would even apply to, and even then it's arguable if it actually even applies to them, quite frankly. But there was such a concern from the industry about an over-regulation from the startup side. This has nothing to do with that. And then the principles that are outlined on the defense and the contracting side, et cetera, are things that if you're a startup engaging this space anyway, we'd probably have a problem with you all the same in engages of deep fakes for elections, et cetera. So I think that you're right. My conversations with them have been very specific about how can a local government be driving this? Because we're at the, I mean, they're dealing with defense contracts and election security, but I'm implementing actual elections at the county level, right? So we're at the grassroots level, that's the grass tops level. How can the grassroots level inform the grass tops decision-making process? And that's why I felt it was important to go about the values-based system and also be able to provide specific examples of how it's being used on the ground. Because look, before we even had a regulatory framework at the county, we're able to document in 3 months 36,000 unique uses of just ChatGPT on county servers. I mean, so it was, I mean, people are using it and they're using it without guardrails. And so let's embrace the fact that they're using it, have found a way to help it improve customer service, but also they were using it in health and human services where people were putting personal identifying information in there. They were using it in jail systems. I mean, they're using it in ways that I don't think most of the people would agree is appropriate. So that's my conversations with the administration. We're informing them how we were using it, saying that that we can be a laboratory at local levels in a way that the federal government can't, and to say that this is how it's actually being operationalized in a government structure on the ground, and then how can we partner with you on that?
I'm glad that you brought up the conversation that you had around open source, small businesses, and startups as it relates to this regulation, because it's also happening in what the EU did. A lot of the folks out there that are critical of that AI Act, it's mostly with companies that are building foundational models. It's not so much the folks that are on the application layer. That seems to be okay. There's room to innovate. It's, you know, I think a lot of this conversation around stifling innovation is happening at a very, very kind of very large company conversation. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit. Talk about the tension between innovation and regulation and where you land on that.
I think that we have an opportunity to get it right now in a way that we didn't previously with either the, I guess you could say even the internet writ large and some of the guiding principles that we're still operating under in that way. And in particular, social media, which I think that would be very hard to argue. We're pleased with some of the outcomes associated with that, in particular with how it's impacted youth. However, the thing that I think is very important here and the way that I view it is that I think that in particular startups and to a lesser degree some of the larger players who are already operating in a regulatory framework, the Googles, Microsoft in particular, that have dealt with significant amount of antitrust issues primarily in Europe and to a lesser degree here in the United States, I mean, they are coming to the table saying, please regulate us. But of course, they would be saying that because they've been existing in a regulatory framework that's been punishing them for some time. But to me, I think it's the startup level where there's this sense that any regulation at all, I mean, you could be Lyft and Uber, and they were pushing hard against taxi regulations in the day, if you may remember that, or you could be an AI startup. They actually should be at the, or Airbnb, right, who was fighting all regulations at the beginning. And my arguments to these companies early on in my community was, instead of fighting it, why don't you have a seat at the table to help shape it? This isn't going to say, this isn't the oil industry drafting some sort of, you know, environmental regulations. It's not like that. But at the end of the day, you're going to have a skill set I'm not going to have. And we're going to have a skill set that you may not have. And when government feels threatened by something, or a community does and pushes elected leaders, you are going to get a result that's basically going to be closer to the banning or overregulation than not. So just from an ethos standpoint, my viewpoint is come to the table, help shape that regulation like we did in our county at the startup level, and then use that to trade up the chain to actually make that be the state regulatory model in California, for example, or the national regulatory model. This is totally doable because it's undefined space. I think that what's happening in Europe, I mean, just from my reading of what is proposed, is actually much stricter than I think that what we should probably do in the United States. And I think it will actually stifle innovation in Europe, and it actually may be an interesting rebirth and boon to Silicon Valley in a way that it hasn't been in a while, because there's been some innovative loss in Silicon Valley I feel like they might be taking a too regulatory forward approach.
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting point. Last time we talked, you told me about your use of ChatGPT and the way that you're using the tool. And it's interesting because a lot of politicians that I talk to in the state of Washington, state of California, many of them haven't really experienced it themselves. And I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit. How is it showing up for you on a day-to-day basis? And where are you seeing the value for your work?
I find that it's more useful for folks I work with than for me directly, I'll say. And maybe it's because I'm not an expert at the prompts yet. But it does feel that some of the content still feels a little clearly computer generated, if I may, when I'm providing, if I'm writing materials, for example. But with that said, I have found there are some relatively esoteric things that government does. I mean, that don't sound very exciting, but, you know, there, we've received requests from a trust. Somebody passes away and they need a lot of records regarding their family member, for example. This is currently all done by hand. The ability to write a prompt to gather the information out is saving hundreds and hundreds of hours of staff time that have to be charged back to this person, right? We are seeing that already. Yeah. And I think that part of it is that we don't even know what we don't even know in what's possible on this. But on a day-to-day operating level, we're using the systems internally in the county. And these are constituents that are asking me for help that I'm then in turn asking county staff for help that are using it to pull out information. I find that to be very good. For me, in, as far as generating content or speeches or that kind of stuff, I don't feel like I'm quite there yet with, or maybe I'm just very picky in regards to it. But I have to say, you know, you upload enough of your things that you've written and it gets a little eerie about how it picks up your tone and your voice very quickly. But I think that the most important takeaway here is that I think that this is the way it's going to be. I mean, I have a 9-year-old and I think that it's going to be incorporated into his education system in the high school level in particular. And so I think we have to understand and accept the fact that this is it. Like, we view things as social media isn't really social media. It's used as a primary source of media for most young folks right now.
Yeah.
Same too as I think AI is going to be a primary source of both information gathering as well as information output. And we shouldn't differentiate it. It's like we're kind of treating it like it's this unique thing. And in essence, it's just going to be incorporated in society within this next generation very quickly.
I think you're right. I think education is going to play a big part in the way that this plays out. I really need to ask you, though, about this election cycle coming up. Since this is our AI show on politics, what happened in Argentina recently and the kind of AI that we saw show up in posters and messaging, you've spent a long career working in communications at the White House, Congress. What are you thinking about in terms of this election cycle? It's really the first time that we've had Gen AI in a major US election. What's coming to mind for you?
Well, I think that my concern is less on the things that have been already vocalized, the deep fakes, the voices, the video, because I think that society has some sense of inoculation a little bit toward that. I mean, meaning that I think that there's already a distrust, as odd as that sounds, of information coming from those sources.
Yeah.
I think the bigger concern, and actually I listened to an interview that Sam Altman did, that he actually expressed something similar. And I mean, I'm not quoting him on this, but sort of to just paraphrase the generality, is that it has the ability to so micro-target information based on your preferences. That's concerning to me. Because as an elected official, I have a general sense of why people vote for me. As a communications person who's worked on many presidential campaigns, we sort of top line healthcare as a message or whatever. And then we have some sub elements that might be interesting to somebody in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, that isn't maybe interesting to somebody in Austin, Texas. In this situation, though, and this already exists, this skill, I know what your what you specifically are interested in because of how much is already available about you, and can micro target an interest message in a way that is so hyper personal to you and your family that it can influence elections. And it may not necessarily be real, meaning it may not actually necessarily be the position of a candidate per se, but you can create a fake in a way. So it's not about copying my voice from this interview that we're doing right now. I think there's antibodies to that. It's the reception of information that's so hyper-personalized. It's like the original Google ads that you would get on Gmail. But I mean, to the nth degree. That, I think, is something that's totally unexplored that actually concerns me in the 2024 election of how that's going to be weaponized.
That's really interesting. I haven't thought about that, but personalization is going to be a big thing for consumers, and why wouldn't it show up in elections? So that makes a ton of sense. Another question I have for you is related to the time that you spent in Democratic administrations. Now, you've served in three Democratic administrations in the White House. And I wonder about the mentors that you've had along the way. I like to ask this mentorship question, and very few people that come on the show have had the kind of experiences that you've had in politics. Who are the mentors that have shown up for you throughout your career?
You know, I read this thing that, this is a long time ago, actually, that I read this. I was in grad school, and I read this thing about that, you know, when you're a kid, you think your parents are brilliant, you become a teenager and they don't know anything. And then you see the curve, right? And you become in your early 20s and maybe they kind of know something in your late 20s. And when you have your first kid, they're brilliant again, right?
Yeah.
And I think that Absolutely. It is actually safe to say that, in particular, upon reflection, both of my parents have had an outsized role in how I think about the world. And they're exceptionally ethical people, and they're very public-centered, even though they aren't in public service. So I think that while it might seem kind of canned, the reality is that I have to give them the pole positions on that. I will say, too, though, I've worked for a lot of political folks in my life, and unequivocally I can say that Barack Obama was a generational talent. And my conversations with him were always amazing. Just also watching how he would interact with people, answer questions, but his ability to tune out noise or separate the wheat from everything else was very unbelievable. I mean, we'd be doing events where there was 20, 30,000 people there just cheering his name, and he could be locked in on a one-on-one interview as though they're not there and hyper-personalize it. So he had a What I learned from him was the difference between what's important and what's urgent. They're not always the exact same thing. He had an expression that he would use that good policy or good politics. So don't think about the politics of something, just do what's right. And it actually ends up working out at the end. And I think that it's very telling how many of his former team have gone on to do a lot of things, form nonprofits, run for office. I mean, they've stayed in the broader space. So unequivocally, I would view him that way as well. And I'll say that the teams that the friendships that we have and the relationships I still have with those that worked on the team continue to inspire me. A lot of those folks are in the White House today. They were at this event that I was at last week. I mean, it's amazing to see that.
Yeah, it is amazing. That's great. Well, as you think about the future, you're in a really, really good position as a lot of this regulation unfolds. You know, we're still very, very early in AI, but we're even earlier in terms of policy and regulation. A lot of this stuff's going to start shaping up over the next few years. As you look out into the future, what are the things that are bringing you energy? What are the things you're excited about as it relates to this emerging technology?
I think this has the ability to be, I think we're coming up to a fork in the road. And not to say the Yogi Berra, if you come to a fork, take it, which was his expression. I think that it actually could go either way. I don't have a fear of the doomsday scenarios that are being presented. I think that actually isn't that realistic. But I think the lack of harnessing of the transformational opportunities. So let me tell you, I mean, I'm operating in a space that's very easy to get down on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you get the way that the public interacts with elected officials has changed over time. There seems to be, and I think a lot of people listening here would agree, there just seems to be this undercurrent of frustration and anger in systems and a lack of trust, and whether that's in the educational or faith systems or government, it's just pervasive. There is something to me about the potential of AI for climate change, for, you know, we're talking about deep fakes. It also has the ability for actually being the way that you determine whether information is real or not. I mean, it has the ability to determine if something was generated that way. It almost, it's to me, it's augmenting the collective human intelligence in a way that we've never been able to do before. And if we can harness that, the things that we screwed up along the way in the world and the climate and famine and things that are going to continue to contribute to strife, I think can really be addressed through this. That is exceptionally exciting. That's why I'm passionate. I mean, I'm not a particularly exciting guy when it comes to regulatory. Like, I don't wake up every day thinking about regulatory frameworks, but I am passionate about the idea of how we can get this one right, because the potential is so much more than anything else we've touched before. I think that's really exciting. And I think that it's important for industry folks to know the government has a role there in a way that can be beneficial, and to see that they've got a seat at the table in a way they never have before.
I certainly hope you're right. I'm excited about it too, and I hope it can solve some of these big ideas that we've yet solved. So I always ask this question at the end of the show. If you could describe the future of work in two words, what would those two words be? And then you can elaborate.
I think the two words that come to mind are cautious abundance. I think we have the potential for great abundance of things that the world needs because of technological innovation. The caution part is that crossroads component that I mentioned before. Will we get it right? You know, throughout history, we've met moments, and we're at a point in time right now. And I think it's really hard to recognize when you're actually living at a point in time of great consequence in history. It just is, because you're living it. You're just doing it. People are still trying to survive. And that's a point, too, that doesn't have to do with these two words, but I think it's important to note that most people aren't looking at this. Most people don't care about this. Most people don't understand this. They're trying to live their lives. This is not a top 5, 10, or 20 thing on a poll as something people are interested in, right? Because they don't see how it's going to impact their day-to-day lives yet. The caution part is, will we get it right? The abundance part is, if we do, a lot of the things that I've dedicated my professional life to, of equity and justice, and making sure in particular the most disadvantaged have a shot. I think this has a way of doing things that, and solving problems in ways that I could never or individually understand in a collective way. And so I'm very excited about that. My nerve is just, will we get it right?
Yeah, I love that. Well, it's clearly in your backyard. We saw drama unfold with Sam Altman and his board, and a lot of that tension was around acceleration and safety. And you're living that right now in your county and also at the federal level. And I'm really, really pleased that we were able to dig in on some of this policy stuff as it relates to AI, because it is the perfect time to be talking about it. So thank you, Zach, for being on the show. I really appreciate your time and your insights.
It's such an honor to be with you. I really do appreciate the time as well.
That's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. Such a pleasure to have Zach as our guest on today's episode. Zach's knowledge and experience in government and his views on AI regulation is really forward-thinking. If you want to learn more about Zach, you can find him on LinkedIn and Twitter. If you are interested in how he thinks about AI regulation and policy, definitely connect with him and keep up with his posts and activities online. I continue to be amazed by the guests we've had on the show, and I'm excited about the ones joining us in the near future. I truly appreciate you spending your time with us. Thank you for listening to the episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Shift AI podcast for more exciting interviews, and the Simply AI weekly newsletter for updates on how AI can help you scale your business. The Shift AI podcast is produced and sponsored by Simply Augmented and distributed by GeekWire. Our theme music was created by Dave Angel.